Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here again without Gabe, hoping he'll be back soon. And I believe he will be back soon. There's nothing dramatic, but I'll let him tell you about it when he's back. We're going to talk today about some research that was referred to as the Hunger Games. And this is obviously a reference to the book series and later the movie series. And this research, though, did not pit human beings against each other, competing and killing each other. It pitted or examined four animals doing that. And they weren't competing with each other. They were trying to eat. That's all it was about. They were trying to find food. And what's interesting is that these four animals have different sized brains, and they were only looking for one kind of food. And that means you can figure out, does the size of the brain matter when it comes to finding food?
Science Unscripted.
Hi, my name's Meg Crowfoot. I'm a researcher who studies animal behavior, and I've spent most of the past 20 years running around the jungles of Panama watching monkeys.
Meg, together with colleagues, you tried to answer a question that has been asked apparently for years, maybe decades, and that has not been answered. Let's start there. What was that question?
Well, when you think about what makes us, what makes humans such a strange animal, one of the first things that pops into your mind is our very, very large brain. And so scientists have been asking questions for a long time about how it is, why it is that we have evolved such an enormous and very costly organ. And one of the main hypotheses, one of the main ideas about why it is that humans in particular, but primates in general, have seen this expansion of our brain over evolutionary time, that it's related to the fact that we solve complex puzzles to find our food.
So big brain equals more food. That's the logic, or that's been the hypothesis, at least for a while now.
Or alternately, hard task to find food needs a large brain. But yes, these things are intertwined with one another. The idea that when you have a large brain, you need a lot of energy to run that large brain. So you have to forage efficiently. You have to solve your puzzle of finding food well. But also, the better you can solve that puzzle, the more efficiently you can forage, the more you can afford to support a large, energetically expensive tissue like our brain.
And what I've understood from your paper is that to test that, to create an experiment in the lab is prohibitively difficult. And so instead, you and your colleagues went to an island in Panama and did what exactly?
Well, so we work on an island actually in the Panama Canal, right smack dab in the middle of the Panama Canal. And what we were aiming to do was to actually, for the first time, test the hypothesis that having a big brain, that animals with bigger brains actually are able to find food better, more efficiently than animals with smaller brains.
And I know we're kind of jumping ahead here, but let's just get right to the conclusion. What'd you find? Is that true? Bigger brain equals you get more food? Is that what you found?
Nope. And I love that answer. No, we didn't find that at all. In fact, what we found was that all of the species that we tested were able to solve this ecological problem about the same, about as well as each other.
Let's start with the ecological problem first. What was it exactly? What were these animals trying to get?
Well, when you're a frugivore, which means an animal that mostly eats fruit, you have to not only find that fruit. So it's not only about locating kind of where, which trees have fruit, but it's also about getting to them at the right time. Because of course, as we all know, an apple tree doesn't have apples all year round. The same is true in a tropical forest. Particular species only have fruit at particular times of year, not necessarily all at the same time. And so you have to navigate through an environment where most things don't have food for you to find the few things that do.
And if I understand your paper correctly, it was the Dipteryx tree or the fruit on there. What is this? It looked kind of like a big pear. Is that what they're trying to eat?
So they're eating a fruit, yes, it comes from the Dipteryx oleifera tree. So this is a big brown fruit. So it's a big seed covered with just a thin skim of pulp that is actually quite sugar rich. So I've tasted them. They taste delicious when they're ripe.
And who or which animals were looking for these fruits?
Well, so part of the reason we actually started this project in the first place, and particularly started it in Panama, was because there's this one time of year when Dipteryx is really the only fruit species on the island or in this forest that is producing fruit, which means we have kind of a simplified puzzle that has to be solved, both for us and for the animals. And so really, because it's the only game in town, so to speak, all of the fruit-eating animals on the island are focusing on Dipteryx during this period. They're all having to solve the same ecological puzzle. And so we ended up with four species, two primates, spider monkeys, and capuchin monkeys, and then two frugivorous carnivores, or procyonids, so coatis and kinkajous.
Can you help me imagine what a coati and a kinkajou looks like?
Sure. Coatis, they sort of look like a raccoon, but with a more pointy face. And kinkajous are really interesting because they look an awful lot like a primate. They live in the trees, and they're about the size of a house cat, say 2.5-3 kilograms, and a beautiful sort of orangey-brown color with very big eyes because they're nocturnal and very cute faces.
And with each of these four animals, you made sure to look at their, what I believe is called their encephalological quotient, the size of the brain to the body.
Encephalization quotient, yes. So, of course, a blue whale has a bigger brain than a mouse, but that isn't really necessarily telling us much about kind of the function of that brain. And so we use what's called the encephalization quotient to compare, basically to sort of standardize, to create an even playing field and look at whether your brain is bigger than we'd expect based on your body size or smaller than we'd expect based on your body size.
And I'm rounding some numbers here, but it lined up really well. A capuchin had a number of 4, an EQ, encephalization quotient of 4, spider monkey roughly 3, kinkajou 2, coatis, if I'm saying that right, a 1. So big differences in brain size relative to body, and yet they all found food the same?
Well, I wouldn't say that they found food exactly the same, but they found it equally efficiently. There weren't big differences in efficiency. So all of these species differ quite a bit in how they use their habitats. Some species, like the spider monkeys, have much bigger home ranges. The kinkajous have much smaller home ranges. But when you look at how much time they're spending eating as a function of how far they have to travel to do it, they all performed about the same.
And how do you measure that? Do you have cameras out there? Do you track them? What'd you do?
So we used GPS-based tracking to track the animals' movements as well as their activity patterns. So we put collars on each of the animals that we studied that gave us a location estimate of where they were in the forest every 4 minutes.
And that's enough to know, okay, they're definitely around this tree that's producing fruit, and they're more likely than not, they're eating that fruit.
Well, what's kind of unique about this study and about this system more generally is because Dipteryx is the only thing really producing fruit, or is the thing that producing the vast majority of food at this period of time. And because it's this big canopy emergent tree that flowers a beautiful pink-purple color in early July, we were able to fly drones over the island about 6 months before we started tracking the animals and map every single purple-pink blob in our imagery and know that those trees that had flowered were going to have fruit 6 months later. So we knew the location of every possible feeding tree. And then with these movement data, are able to say, okay, this animal, we're following a spider monkey, we're looking at the data from a spider monkey, and we have a little cluster of points, which mean, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 location estimates that happens to overlap with a known tree crown. So we can see each of their visits into these known fruiting trees, but we can also see which trees they don't visit.
If the size of their brain relative to their body doesn't impact the amount of food that they're getting, why do we have this big old brain that consumes so many calories per day and has so many evolutionary and biological costs? If it's not to make sure I get enough food and don't die, what is it for?
Well, I think that remains a mystery. It's something that we are still working to figure out. It still may be related to food. So there are ideas out there that extractive foraging, the idea that you are not just eating things that you pick up off a tree or, you know, off the ground or grass that you can just put your head down and eat, but instead that you are having to work to get food items out of something. So think about digging through dead wood to get at the grubs of insects, or think about using stone tools to extract the nuts from seeds. So there's one idea that brain size is related to that ability to extractively forage. But there is also the idea that brain size is really about what you do socially.
And your research would sort of suggest that it's much more the social factor. These big brains are so that we can communicate with and manage large groups of similar beings?
I guess I wouldn't necessarily say that yet. I think we still don't know. I think what our study shows is that you don't need a big brain to forage as efficiently as animals with big brains do forage. And I think it points us in directions, both in terms of exploring how and when a big brain is actually useful for foraging tasks, and also does sort of point to questions about the role that sociality is playing. Lots of people have looked at sociality, and the evidence there is still quite equivocal. There isn't strong support for any of these hypotheses, I would say, and it remains kind of an area where I think much more comparative work, this idea that you're looking across many species and their actual behavior when they're performing comparable tasks, is really the way forward.
And that was Professor Margaret Crowfoot. She's a director of the Department for the Ecology of Animal Societies at the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior. And she's also the Alexander von Humboldt Professor at the University of Konstanz. That's down in southern Germany, a beautiful area with a beautiful big lake. And I believe at the moment you're hearing this, it kind of depends when, she's back in Panama. She told me that after the interview, to celebrate 100 years of at least one part of the research facility there on that island in Panama. If you have any questions for Margaret about this research or about brain size or encephalization quotient, the size of your brain compared to the size of your body, feel free to send them to me, su@dw.com, and I will try to get them addressed either by answering them directly or in connection with Margaret. And that's it. Thanks for listening.
Don't know what that bird call is.